Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, friends. This is Paula Thompson coming to you from Colorado. Our host, Ann Garner, has been interrupted for the time being. She didn't have the PIN number to start the show, so I'm hoping Ann will call in any minute. I'm just helping her out. On the line, I'm sure we have Elizabeth Esperson, and I hope we have Ann, too. Ann, are you there?
Yes. Paula, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Thank you so much. There was a problem. I've had some connection problems here in California already, so that the numbers wouldn't go through, even with the PIN number. Elizabeth, are you there?
I am here.
Hello. Well, this is Dynamic with Live Broadcasting. Thank you so much, Paula.
My pleasure, sweetheart. I'm going to put it on mute. If you need me, just let me know through the board, okay? Because I don't want
Thank
my phone.
I understand. And we will need you when we start talking about the Holy Land trip. And I've already been knocked off the chat room, so it's mighty interesting. Elizabeth,
right.
Don't you love it? You're so used to working under pressure.
Not anymore. Not anymore. I don't do that anymore.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, and it's all going to be mighty fine. Well, welcome, everyone, to Blog Talk Radio Cosmic Citizen. This is Ann Garner, your Wednesday host. This is the sister broadcast to the Saturday broadcast. You just heard the host, Paula Thompson, my longtime buddy that I've traveled with for many years, and her other co-host is Crystalyn Beek and Diane LeBrec. My special guest today is Elizabeth Esperson. And Elizabeth, we have your bio on the website, and that was exciting putting that together, because it's always dynamic, because you have such a rich background in your religious, spiritual life, Thanksgiving Square, Interfaith, including the NANE Network. And so everyone can go, instead of taking a lot of time to read all that, they can just simply, I'm sure most people have already read that. Elizabeth, what I want to ask you first of all, hi, welcome. And what made you decide to become a Catholic nun? That's a pretty drastic step to take in life.
Well, it wasn't quite so drastic back in the 50s when I did it. But I would say that the call of God is a very powerful experience. And that call is what moved me. I had known from the time I was a very small child that my life would be a life for God in a very special way. And I saw in the religious community of women where I went to high school, I saw in those women a purity and a goodness and a happiness that certainly influenced me. But I would say it was just a very strong and positive sense that that's what God wanted me to do. Mm. And that's what I did.
Well, now, were you raised a Catholic?
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yes,
and was it just a natural process? Because the majority of people on this planet cannot imagine the kind of commitment, lifestyle that it takes, requires, because you gave up. As far as relationships, you had to forego any idea. Well, I won't say any idea, because I know you did fall in love at a very young age. Was that difficult to walk away from that?
I'm not sure that difficult is the right word. Obviously, yes, but the call of God is a very powerful thing, and the service of God and the lifestyle it's much more radical today than it was back in the 50s when there was a much stronger sense of that and of living religious life. There were many people going into priesthood and religious life back in those days. And I came from, yes, a Catholic family. My parents were both Catholics, and their parents were Catholics. And we grew up going to Catholic schools, which you don't do that so much in this day and age because you don't have as many Catholic schools anywhere. And here in the Northeast, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, here in the Northeast where I lived, Catholicism was very, very strong in major cities. You know, it was probably the number one religion back in those days, still is in many Northeastern cities. But I think that between the human person and the divine, there's always an interaction and an interrelationship going on, and if one opens oneself to that, then one begins to experience what it is that God wants of one, and life unfolds and things like that become possible. I mean, that's the way it was for me. And the more you open yourself to the experience of God, and I think this is true in not just the Christian religion, but in other religious traditions also. The more God comes into your life, the more God shows you of him herself so that you can then respond. So whereas for many people on the planet today, as you say, you know, it seems strange and unusual to think about a way of life like that, you find people with a very strong sense of God and who want to do what God asks of them and be as God wants them to be.
I had a very powerful minister call me day before yesterday who really walks in the gifts. You've heard me talk about him in the past. And he was talking about there are some, now this is his opinion, as a Christian minister who is very powerful, like say in the gifts, he said, and there are some that are totally predestined to walk in a contemplative lifestyle because he lives he's with people a lot in a way, but he has to live in a very contemplative lifestyle in order to function. And in the framework of the Urantia book, and you have read the book, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, there is a pattern, a plan set forth for each one of us if we choose to take that. And what do you think? What would you say to people? Because I know, having traveled with you, you know, I've often said you either live with somebody or travel with them extensively, and you'll really get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And you have such a peace and such, and I'm not attaching this to your ego because the ego with you has been so subdued over the years. How do people know, well, this is where I'm supposed to be? This is the plan of God. That's a huge question. I know we didn't to talk about that before, but that is a huge question I get over and over and over from people.
How do people know the plan of God for them, or that it is the plan of God for them? I think in my case, in many instances, it was how life came to me and opportunities that opened up. For example, going off into the desert at 39.
Now, that was interesting. You went to the desert, and I know I've encouraged you to write about that experience. And our dear friend, who ended up being a bestseller author, that we sat in the airport one day, you and the three of us, she always wanted you to write about that because you lived a totally solitude life for a while. You would walk down this little road to get – it was quite remarkable.
Well, that was at the Monastery of Christ in the Desert in New Mexico back in the 70s. I spent 7 months, as their first long-term guest and living about a quarter of a mile away from the monastery itself. But that's an example. My whole life deepened through that experience, and I came face to face, as I think you have to do if you're going to have a relationship with God. I came face to face with the mucky murkiness of myself after about 3 weeks there. You know, I just thought, ugh, what have I done coming out here, and so on and so forth. And eventually you have to just let yourself go and give yourself over to God and God's mercy, God's grace. And then what happens when you do that is that the whole world, God lets the whole world come into your life, and your prayer, even in a very contemplative situation, is aware of the needs of the world and how we must truly be praying one for another in this world. So I suspect that there are many ways to know the plan of God for us, but basically I think it's going to involve being at the disposal of God. Within Christianity, the idea of God's will be done. You know, your
God's will be done,
Lord.
And you will. There is a peace that comes when you're in the will of
when
God.
I've often said
I don't always know what the will of God is, but I know when I'm totally out of the will of God.
Yes, even if you're not sure of what the will of God is, you can still be willing to do that will as God manifests it to you.
Right.
So I think, you know, the ego business, what's in this for me? What am I getting out of this? Is it, do you approach it that way with a great big ego, or do you give yourself over to God and trust in God and be ready to do what God asks of you?
Right. Well, now the next big question, because how long were you a nun?
27 years.
That's a long time. And then
it
you made a drastic decision to move away from that lifestyle. And what had you already opened up? Because this is a very critical question, because people would assume, as a Catholic, had you already opened up to the concept of that the other traditions were worthy of that highest regard and respect, or did that come later?
I had always had an awareness of people in other faith traditions, both within Christianity and beyond Christianity, because my father knew a lot of people besides Catholics. He was a banking officer in Buffalo, and we had people visit our home frequently. So I had a sense that there were other cultures, other ways of looking at life, other religions, etc. So, and that was a part of the openness, I think, that my parents instilled in me. And so the basis was there, but the full flowering of interest in and work with other religions, as I did it at Thanksgiving Square, came when I was at Thanksgiving Square. After I got there, the full realization of all of that came then.
So what made you decide to take that drastic step of leaving?
It was something that had been coming on for a number of years, I think. The work that I was doing was taking me out beyond the community into the whole diocesan picture. I was working with permanent deacons. I had come back from the desert and been asked to become an associate director of the permanent diaconate program. And what I had to do with them was to train them in prayer and spirituality. And when you talk about the way God prepares you for life and the way you walk with God. Here I was out in the desert making the discoveries of prayer and contemplative living and spirituality and living the liturgical year intensely and all of that. And then when I came back and worked with the deacon program in Buffalo, I had an opportunity to use everything that I had experienced in the desert in teaching prayer and spirituality, not only to the men who would be ordained deacons, but also to their wives. So, you know, God prepares you. God uses you.
Well, I know with me, I consider you my mentor in interfaith.
I consider you mine. So.
Oh, you do? Oh, my God. Well, experientially, I would never. It's just a remarkable experience. And what it does, what you set up a long time ago, because a lot of people don't realize how far back interfaith goes in Dallas-Fort Worth. And you on this continent, you really were a groundbreaker in that. Yeah, I'm thinking of a quote from the Bible, what good can come out of Dallas, you know? Because most people think there's no way you could have interfaith functioning there. And as you know, because of the pioneer efforts, we're actually now have an interfaith coalition committee, of which I'm blessed to be a part of, that's putting a proposal together to bring the Parliament of World Religions to Dallas in 2014.
Yes, I know you've told me that. That's exciting.
And three of our co-chair and one of the committee chairs, they're in Chicago right now in that proposal process.
Oh,
and
good.
I called on you for your wisdom, for your advice, your input, and it was very valuable. And we need to hear from you. And Thanksgiving Square, and before we get to the North American Interfaith Network, which you co-founded, and for those of you listening, Elizabeth, Thanksgiving Square, would you describe the purpose of Thanksgiving Square? Because you really get it. You embody it.
Well, Thanksgiving Square.
Sometimes people don't get it.
Well, Thanksgiving Square was founded to use the concept of gratitude and thanksgiving as a bridge builder among cultures and religions and peoples. And the idea of it was that in the center of a city, and in this instance, in the center of a modern city, could there be a place, a physical place, where the idea of gratefulness, thankfulness, could be a bridge builder in the heart of the city. In ancient Athens and Rome, you had the temple or the basilica or whatever, you know, sort of the center of the whole city. And Peter Stuart, to his credit and great genius, had this idea and really worked, and I think over many years stirred up the excitement and admiration of the people of Dallas and the people of Dallas and of the Metroplex, which is Dallas-Fort Worth, to their credit, you know, have been supportive of it. But this idea of a spiritual center and using a concept that is universal. And the very first time I went to Thanksgiving Square, it was to work on a seminar that raised the question, is Thanksgiving universal? It was the first seminar that they did to see if this was something that could be used to reach out to peoples all over the world. And as you know, that has been very successful. And it has happened. The Square has done really phenomenal work.
Well, and there's a Bible scripture that, and it also, the Urantia book says this, that you really aren't praying without gratitude. I'm trying to think of the scripture that with prayers of thanksgiving, and the Lord's Prayer that Jesus brought forth was really about being grateful.
Oh, of course.
And that opens up the door because, you know, self-centered prayer is not going to get answered anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible. And so I know for me, if I am grateful for a situation, there's a consciousness, a shift in me instantly. Even if in the beginning it was, you know, in my immature days, of course we'll always be immature as long as we live on this planet, cosmically speaking, that if I did not take time, wow, I am thankful for this. And by the way, right now I'm thankful for, I will not complain again about the traffic in Dallas-Fort Worth. I've been trying to get through Los Angeles, and it is unbelievable. And people are in such a hurry, you know. It reminds me of New York City. They'll just honk, and I'm like, wait, we're at a red light. There's nowhere to go. But that reflects that's a minor thing, but yet it's a huge thing. Road rage is an inner turmoil within a person. Well, I know when I want to get back to the square. When the square first, the concept and the founding, you know, I watched it being built from my office there, right by the, and
right.
I was there at the opening. It was an interfaith thing from the beginning.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Can you describe that, please? Which religions were involved is what I'm asking, yes.
I think from the very beginning there were Jews and Muslims and Christians, as I recall. When there was the opportunity to bring in Buddhists and Hindus, those people were brought in, and then gradually we came to know Sikhs and Jains and Baha'is and so on and so forth, and Native American peoples. The Native Americans were present in one way or another at the beginning also. But Peter Stewart was very conscious of the fact that there were people of other faith traditions living in the Dallas area, and he wanted their wisdom. And I think through his contacts and through even some business people that he knew, he found the right people and was not afraid to ask, you know, who are the ones that can really help with this, that can really talk with us about it and give us some direction. It was actually, as I recall, and remember I've been away from this for 10 years now, but as I recall, it was the educators that he brought together to discuss the idea of the spiritual center at the heart of the modern city and what would be a way to work with it. And it was educators who suggested the concept of gratitude. For one reason, as you say, gratitude is at the heart of all genuine prayer. But then also there's a very strong tradition of gratitude that from the very beginning was part of this country, part of America, and that has evolved into our Thanksgiving Day. And there are not a whole lot of countries in the world that have a Thanksgiving Day or even a consciousness of that. And,
well,
and
I know
people,
that, yeah, that you really have done a lot of research on that. Since we had some technical difficulties coming in, I do want to get to, we do have someone on the board calling in. I see him now. No, I don't think that's who I thought it was. But it is someone that wants to say hello to you. If Paula, if you're listening, would you please put through that 214? Hello, you're on the air, 214. You want to say hello?
Hello, Elizabeth. This is Ed Gruby at Dallas.
Oh, State. I know who it is. How are you, Ed Gruby?
It's good to talk to you. And
hello.
I just wanted to tell you that you have not been forgotten here at Thanksgiving Square or in Dallas. Your name is synonymous with Thanksgiving and what it stands for. And the gratitude and even attitudes have been changed by your work here in Dallas for the many years that you were at Thanksgiving Square, even above and beyond when you were here and since you've been gone. And I just wanted to
add, thank you.
It's been wonderful working with you for the 10 years that we were together.
And yeah.
I learned so much from you about Thanksgiving and the real meaning of Thanksgiving. And I appreciate all that you taught me and all that we went through. And it was very good.
Ed, tell me, how are the pumps?
The pumps are, we're working on them right now. In fact, I've got to go take care of two of them right now.
Ed, can I ask you, how much water is pumped through there every day?
With the three pumps, if all of the pumps are running, we run pretty close to 350,000 gallons, 400,000 gallons in an hour, hour and a half time with all the pumps running. But it's amazing what we can do with them. But it takes constant taking care of them and working on them to keep them going.
And there's nobody that can do it as well as you.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know what they do when I'm gone, but
those that have never looked at Thanksgiving Square on the web, you can go to thanksgiving.org and put a dash, right? Thanks-giving. It's a beautiful walkways and gardens and trees, and we just have to, the birds, people keep feeding the birds, and that draws them, but we're still working on that, Ed, and also we're working on the people deciding to bring their dogs there and not having respect. But we're just speaking that over the world airways now, that be resolved.
Well, something that Elizabeth would be interested in is that this coming Saturday, we're taking the three bells down. The three big bells are coming down to be worked on. We've got to repair and the yokes that hold the bells up there. And
uh-huh.
So they're coming down for the first time in 33 years. And,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's going to be a big ordeal. And so it's going to be good.
Well, thank you for calling. So thank you so much, Ed. Thank you so much.
Yes, thanks, Ed, and my greeting to everybody.
Thank you, and we love you, and we pray for y'all, and y'all take care.
Okay, bye. Thanks, Ed.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, now let's move forward because we do have another caller, and we'll be bringing him in a minute. And I am nervous. I am shaking in my boots because he is a professional broadcaster. And you know who it is, Elizabeth. In fact, let's go ahead, Paul, and bring him in so he can say hello to Elizabeth. It's another 214.
And I can't do that because I've been kicked off because somebody else logged in as the Cosmic Citizen. So I think you can go ahead and do it if you want.
Wow, I didn't do that. That's interesting. Let's see. Hi, Paul. Well, this has been dynamic, but the gentleman we're bringing in totally understands live broadcasting. Hello, 214, you're on
the
air.
Hello, hi, Ann. Hi, Elizabeth.
Tracy Rowland, how are you?
I'm doing great, Elizabeth. How are you? It's so good to hear your voice.
Well, thank you very much. I'm good. I'm enjoying this little conversation here. Are you still at Channel 11?
No, I'm retired now, Elizabeth. I retired last year. I was at 25 years over at the ABC or Channel 8 and then 10 years at Channel 11. But, in fact, my wife and I were just talking about this last night. It is a marvelous time in our lives. They call it the golden years. For some, perhaps that's not true, but for us it certainly is.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. Are you doing any
traveling? Well, Tracy, you were the TV anchor. I tell people you are the Walter Cronkite for the Southwest.
Well, I think that just means that I'm old.
No, you're not, Tracy.
Thank you very much for saying that, Anna.
And we appreciate you calling in. And this is leading up to what we're going to talk about because of our interfaith experiences. That and Elizabeth will help co-found the North American Interfaith Network. And Elizabeth, we'll come back to that. But since we have Tracy on the air,
as long as we have Tracy, let's reminisce.
Let's reminisce. That Tracy, did you get my email? I try, and I'm not nervous because I have traveled with you, and that's what we're going to talk about. You're truly a true television journalist. And you,
well,
you call
know,
it the way
my,
it is with, sir?
Well, you know, in my day, we were taught that journalism comes first. I don't think that's necessarily the case anymore, and television news has changed so much. But for your listeners, of course, the three of us were part of a trip that went to Israel and traveled the Holy Land at one end of Israel to the other, and it was really a marvelous experience. We were led by Dr. Don Benton, and you know, that was you talk about an interfaith group. We had a real eclectic group on that trip.
Well, we did, and people were open and intelligent,
yep,
and curious to know and to understand. And between you and Christine
Wicker.
Going off to Ramallah when the rest of us were somewhere else, and then we were all worried about you being able to get back and so on and so forth.
Well, for people who may not know, Elizabeth, Christine Wicker at that time was the one of the religion reporters and editors for the Dallas Morning News.
For the Dallas Morning News, yes.
Right, and her husband is Phil Seed. Phil, at that time, was teaching at SMU. He today is a professor at USC. And they are, you talk about intelligent people, the two, Christine and Phil are just two of the brightest people I know. But that experience in Ramallah was also something.
Yes, yes. The whole event, experiencing the Muslim faith, the Jewish faith, the Christian faith, you know, all within.
And the Baha'is, Elizabeth.
And the Baha'is.
We went to the Baha'i Temple, and I was just bowled over how beautiful that whole setting is.
Oh, I know. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Tracy, I know we're friends on Facebook, and that's been an incredible way to reconnect. And there was only a few of us on that trip, and how many of us? 12?
12 or 13, something.
And I admired your courage, Tracy, because you did go places that no man dared to go.
Well, we were fortunate. If you remember, Don Benton had set us up with a missionary who was working directly inside the Palestinian camps, and we were able to connect with this fellow who then was able to get us into some really remote areas and frankly, some places where the Israeli officials did not want us to go because they did not consider those areas to be very safe. But so we were able to get inside some homes and talk with people who were not necessarily always accessible to the press.
I think another thing that made that trip so good was the guide that we had. I think his name was Ami.
Yeah.
And he had been a journalist, and he had worked in the Knesset.
That's reporting, right. That's right.
You know, on the activities of the Knesset. And he was so deeply knowledgeable.
Yep.
I remember when he took us up to Masada, you know, and was talking to us about all the different things. I mean, he had a archaeological and historical background as well as his ability as a media person, you know, and he had known Dan Benton for a long time, and so there was a very, you know, just a very comfortable connection in the leadership of that tour.
Can you might tell people who Don Benton is, Tracy, please?
Well, at that time, Don was the pastor at Lovers Lane United Methodist Church in Dallas. Today he works in a retirement. He is himself retired, but he continues to work and works in a retirement community. I see him every so often, but Don was, I don't think there was an interfaith council around, was there, Elizabeth, that Don wasn't at least on the periphery of. He was,
right.
I think, he was one of those people who, I think, really had a heart for God and tried as best he could to try to bring all of his disparate groups under this great heading of Christian together without all of these battles that unfortunately seem to take place between
right.
various groups inside Christianity. And Don, I think, was always just about where you are, Elizabeth, in the fact that he really had an open arm and an open heart for people, regardless of what their background might be.
You know, as I go through this conversation, I remember Muhammad Abdul-Rauf, who was a very good friend of Peter Stewart's. And I remember him saying at one point early on in my years at Thanksgiving Square that he could be more comfortable with a man of faith who was other than Muslim than he would be with some Muslims who didn't have a deep faith. In other words, if you have a deep enough faith, you know the openness of God, and that openness involves others than just the particular religion you may belong to, and so it helps you to open up too. And that was a very strong incentive for me and tenet for me to hold on to during my work at Thanksgiving Square, you know, that openness to the goodness in other people and the deep faith and so on and so forth. So.
Well, and
you know,
one of
the misunderstandings about interfaith work, Tracy, you wrote me back, text me back that you don't lose your own belief system when you're involved.
No, that's absolutely true. No, you don't. You don't.
And that's,
and that's a good point, too, Ann, because I think a lot of folks misunderstand that if you work ecumenically, if you reach out to people who might not have the same point of view on these things theological that you might have, you know, that you'll find common ground, and it doesn't mean that you surrender your basic beliefs and what your faith is. Let's be honest here. I believe that truly Jesus Christ would have to be considered a most ecumenical person, and
exactly.
Reaches out. And if we're going to follow the teachings of Christ, I think we have to be. And that doesn't mean we surrender who we are or what we believe, but that we love one another, which is one of the great commandments, of course.
Yes,
absolutely. And I don't know if you were listening, Tracy. We are proposing, we're part of an interfaith coalition committee to bring the Parliament of World Religions to Dallas in 2014. That's a huge task.
Yes, it is. I heard you say that. And I want to ask you, we won't take up that time now, but I know you'll be doing more programs probably directed at this, I would assume, and I'd like to know more about that. Maybe.
Yes, sir, and I know you're semi-retired, but I'm going to be, we really need your input on this.
Yeah, that would be a good project for you, Tracy.
Okay, you've been nominated second and voted in.
Well,
see, that's what you get for calling.
I'll be happy to help in any way that I can. I, without getting, I certainly don't want to leave your viewers out of our conversation. And I think that most people who have a basic belief of any of our three major faiths, at least, have also a corresponding interest in what we all call the Holy Land. As you had mentioned, Elizabeth, we on our trip. It was one of the most marvelous things because we were able to bring together the three great religions and learn, I think, each one of us personally about different points of view regarding the Holy Land. And
right.
And I'm just curious because I would, for those people who can do it, I'd certainly encourage them to be able to take such a trip. And I was sitting here wondering, and I'd like to ask each of you, is there a particular thing from that trip, which was, what, about 12 years ago? Is that when we went over there? I've been there
96,
twice since
I think.
Then.
Yeah.
So was there anything specifically, one single thing that stands out in your mind from that trip that you might share with your listeners?
I think for me, the very first day that we were there, we did a kind of a breezy walk through the Via Dolorosa.
Right,
and
yeah.
Anne and I and Christine and there was another woman said we wanted to do that more slowly and in a more prayerful way. And we did that. A couple of days later, we had free time. And
right.
The four of us started out. And I remember at one point we sat down to have something for lunch, Anne, and somebody from one of the shops or the little
right.
stalls set up along the way, brought us, whether it was something to drink or just a piece of fruit or something. And we traced the pathway of Jesus very slowly at our own pace, you know, receiving the kindness of strangers and so on. And that was very deeply moving for me.
Yes, and it was very quiet. There weren't many people. And then we went down into the other underground to the other shops that most people don't go to.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite stirring. And also...
Yeah, go ahead.
Also, Tracy, for me personally, I had gone to the Holy Land in 86, but it was wonderful, but it was nothing. There was something, I'm going to use the words, only words I can find, spiritually electrifying about that particular trip, despite the turmoil. Of course, there seems to always be turmoil, but there was a lot of issues going on right then.
Right.
And for you as a journalist, of course, but it was, there were times it got pretty interesting. And then for me to be behind the scenes with you and your cameraman and
Kim Allman, his name.
Yes, I remember him.
And to observe how you chose, and then to come back and see how you reported that. And it takes a lot of courage. People think they don't realize what it takes to do what you did, to go and to do broadcasting like you've done all these years.
Well, we were... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Tracy.
Tracy, tell us what impressed you.
Well, you know, interestingly, it wasn't what I was doing as a journalist on that trip. One might think that would be something that would stand on my mind. Of course, I remember all those things that we were reporting on. But my personal moment came when we were on our boating trip on what's commonly called the Sea of Galilee, like an asset. And we... there was something that was magical, certainly very spiritual, about being out there. And you know, you could almost, and I don't want to put too much of a twist on it, but you could almost see Christ walking across that water. But you had a real sense when he was fleeing the crowds and going from one side of the lake to the other side. And, you know, you have a real sense of what that was like at that time, because you're not too far from what was, for the most part at least, is his stomping grounds. And I was overcome by that. And it stays with me to this very moment. It was a very peaceful kind of thing, a spiritual moment, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know for me, that Sea of Galilee, I've been scanning a few pictures. And Tracy, I hope you've can scan some of yours from that trip. You know, I have an album on my Facebook. And that particular picture, there's those pictures on the Sea of Galilee, our son actually stepped in and commented about the colors. And it wasn't, the film, I went back and looked at the original pictures, and I went, there was something different that day. It's showing up in the pictures.
I'll have to go back and take a look at your Facebook pictures.
Yes, sir.
I was looking. I have all those photos in an album that I put together. But again, for your listeners, if they have an opportunity to do it, it really is sort of an awe-inspiring thing. And most of the tour guides, I think we were fortunate, as you say, Elizabeth, we had no doubt one of the best. But I've been back a couple of times since then, and all of the tour guides that I've come across are trained well, and they know exactly what they're doing. Now, in contrast with some of the, you know, we had so many moments on our trip, but on subsequent trips, it was really hot over there, and in fact, travel was being discouraged for a short period of time. There was an incident, and this is very brief, but you recall that Bethlehem sits down below that corner of Jerusalem. People don't realize how close those two communities are, but they are. And there was a sniper, presumably a Palestinian, who was firing from Bethlehem up to one of the new apartment complexes that they had obviously believed had encroached on their area. So they were shooting up there. They killed a couple of policemen. They killed some people who were living in the apartments. So we rushed to cover this, and I'm standing there, and the Israelis were actually moving tanks in, and it became a really dangerous situation. As I'm standing there reporting with this in the background, and the bullets start, obviously the snipers start shooting at me because bullets were kicking up around my feet. You know, so, and then the cops came, and they put us, pulled us way back, and we couldn't. But the folks who live there are, have this sort of bunker mentality that I think you can't really appreciate until you get over there and see their existence day to day.
Right. I went back in 90, it was either 98 or 99, as one of the guests of the JCRC in Dallas, the Jewish Community Relations Council.
Right.
And that trip was very different from the first one, which was more Christian-based. And this, the second trip I made was much more strongly a presentation of Judaism. And we went right into the bunkers on the Lebanese border and the Syrian border, you know, and we're with the soldiers, and you could see all these fields that had...
Yeah.
Careful mines and all of that, you know, landmines and so on and so forth. But it was a very interesting experience to have both of those, where one emphasis was Jewish and the other was more universal, Christian and universal. Just really, you can't know unless you're there.
Right.
The power
right,
of the place and the diversity of the place and the tension of the place.
Tracy,
well, you know,
and Elizabeth, since both of you are, I truly consider both of you sages in the truest word. Tracy, I'll ask you first, as a journalist, as a lifetime journalist, have you ever done a special, now that you're not under the, you know, because whenever you're working for a network, I'm sure you there's certain guidelines, have you ever considered doing, even on the Internet, what your reflections are about what might possibly bring peace to that volatile part of the world?
Oh, you know, Anne, it's I'm complimented because you'd even ask such a question. I don't know that I, though, would be the person who would have the expertise to even begin to approach such a thing. I think all of us as individuals and as people of faith, excuse me, we have a great concern and a great interest in that area, and certainly would love to see peace there because it's so symbolic of so much, I mean, as we've been touching on here. I don't know, though, that in our lifetimes that's even going to be possible. The resentments, the hatred from one side to the other are so incredibly deep, and as we're watching now, the very militant side of Islam do some really treacherous things in the world. I think that, again, that feeds the anger of many people who, on both sides. And I somehow there has to be this sort of peace offering that can be made and that so that we can bring folks together in true harmony. And I think we're a long way from that.
Yeah,
well, I know that's why I do what I do. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of effort, a lot of diplomacy, because I have people within my own faith community that doesn't understand why I stay so involved in interfaith. Because, you know, these voices have to be louder and firmer than the voices of dissension and discord.
But, you know, another thing I think that's happening today that was not the case back when we went to the Holy Land or earlier on when interfaith work started, when it first started, it was pretty much, it's been going on for thousands of years, I realize, but anyway, this particular movement that we're talking about right now, when it first got its start, it was done mostly by people who were within a religious tradition, either as teacher or minister, priest, you know, sister, whatever, but people who were within a religious tradition and really intellectually curious about other faith traditions and so on. Now, it's not only people who are within a religion professionally, but it is shopkeepers and businesses and corporations and terrorists, etc. Everybody is involved in one way or another, at least in the awareness of interfaith work and whether it's for the good or the bad, simply because of the way things are going, as Tracy indicated, in the world right now. So that means then that we need education and we need to learn the simple basic things of how to be with one another and work with one another beyond the diversities, beyond the differences. And it takes time to learn that in cultures.
Elizabeth, you couldn't be more right. But I also would just like to hasten to say that in the work that you did at Thanksgiving Square, that I think was a clear indication that the work that we do in our local communities can have some far-reaching effects. In other words, you don't have to go to the Middle East and get in the middle of all that's happening over there to do good things and to bring peace about.
Right.
It starts in your heart, of course, but it also starts in your local communities, because that's where we need to get the message out, and that's what both of you are doing, and I respect that and tip my hat to both of you, and I know you're both people of great commitment and great faith, and I love you for it.
Well,
we love
you,
Tracy,
too.
And again, I appreciate you you calling and
yes,
Elizabeth.
Thank you for calling in, Tracy.
Elizabeth, I miss you. I'd love to see you. And if you ever make it back down into this area again, we're going to have to get together. Maybe Ann could join us, and we could go have a nice lunch and a nice chat someplace.
Oh, there's
when we
wonderful.
Have the 2014, I'm going to affirm that.
Okay.
That Elizabeth, we're going to affirm that. And I'm thinking of John 15. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatsoever you will, and it'll be done.
Okay.
Wonderful. Well, I love you both, and thank you so much for having me on the program. I appreciate it, Ann. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tracy. Thank you. Elizabeth, we're down to 5 minutes, but we can stay a little bit longer. And, Tracy, you're welcome to stay on the air with us.
Well, I want to hear
Elizabeth,
you talk about you had mentioned earlier you're going to say something about the Urantia book. I frankly haven't read it. I don't know about it, as I mentioned in one of my emails to you. I know Elizabeth's read it a couple of times, and I'm just curious. I'd like to know what you have to say. So I'm going to hang up and listen a bit more as you folks continue to do your good work here. And
Thanks,
I appreciate being a part of the program.
Thank you. I'll see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, what a blessing, Elizabeth. Now that he really thinks highly of you, and we think.
Well, thank you, but gift of God into our lives, Tracy is.
He's a true friend.
Yeah.
Well, now that he brought up the Urantia book, as a true journalist would, he wanted to get. I know on that trip to the Holy Land, it is important to talk about that, and we are going to go over the one-hour slot slightly. That's the wisdom of our engineer. He does time it, and since we had technical difficulties getting in, and I thank Paula again for getting us in here, during that trip, I had what I call my baby version of Urantia book, the smaller version.
Mm-hmm.
And at night, I'd slip over to the side and look up, according to the Urantia book, where Jesus was at that time, what he was doing, what he was saying.
I remember.
And so what made you decide to read the book? Because I remember when you called me, you got up very early in the morning, every morning. That's the way you are in your discipline.
Well, I read the Urantia book because Gard Jameson had asked me to come to Vancouver when the Urantia Foundation, at one of the Urantia groups was meeting there. Remember that? And I didn't want to go and speak about interfaith work to your Rancho book readers without having some sense of who they were and what they read. And so I made up my mind that I would start, that I would every morning, and this was probably for about 6 months, that I would spend at least half an hour reading the Urantia book. Now, I read the foreword. It begins with the foreword. Is that right?
Yes, you read the foreword. That was
I read the
foreword. Your term. I love the term
it's
you use.
It's chalk. It's just like chalk, like dry, talky chalk in your mouth. But I read it, and I read it twice. And then I started moving through the book. And whereas I'm not a Urantia book reader in the sense that you are, it's not my basis of faith. I found beautiful concepts in it, and certainly many, many quotations, and I've heard them from you, I've heard them from Gard Jameson, quotations about God and about the divine and about our relationship with God and God's loving care of us that move me very deeply. And I did not read the fourth part until after I had read the first, second, and third parts. And I think even that fourth part, because it presents Jesus in a bit of a different context than we're used to him, and yet a plausible context, and shows us someone who is, as in the Bible, very close to the Father and so on and so forth. Even reading that and being open to that, which is a different expression from the one we usually use for thinking about Jesus, it opens your mind. It says, you know, we are made in the image and likeness of God, not God in our image and likeness. And we have to understand, as a Hindu would say, that there is one God, there are many paths to one God.
Hmm. Well, I remember you calling me, and I actually saw in your personal book, you were writing notes, the level of literature, I don't know if that's the right word, of writing. I know you said, Ann, this is very, the quality, the essence is, I don't know the adjective you put on it, but you wrote in your column, in your, out to the side.
Oh,
So thank you for that. And you know, all these years, it's like our good friend Roy, you know, who's gone on to the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
He would walk with me to the garage many times after the meeting, and a great Baptist minister, pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And he would ask me a lot of questions. And then I don't know how many years he said, you know, I'd really like to read that book.
Mm-hmm.
And So this is the way I am. This, again, the interfaith model. And honestly, people don't understand this. I was raised a Baptist. Baptists are very independent, each Baptist church. I guess that's why we're called Baptists. And when I was raised, maybe this is what set it up for me. My mother really focused on the teachings of Jesus because she taught Sunday school to teenagers my entire growing up years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no memory. I've tried to remember. There was nothing like going out and trying to talk people into the kingdom. You know what I'm saying? It has to come from within.
Yeah.
There has to be a quickening. And so, therefore, with that has carried forward for me as a reader of the Urantia book, and I still am involved, strongly involved, in Christian services. And as you know, Elizabeth, I worship with the Sikhs. I'm very comfortable all these years. I meditate with the Buddhist monks. And that's what you brought to the table. I think it's important that you tell people what you brought to the table and you wrote about it in your book, Meeting in Faith. It's one thing to hear about a tradition that's different from yours. It's another thing to read it, but it's another thing to experience it.
But, you know, the reality of the Sikhs in your life and the reality of the Buddhists in your life and what you've given to both of those groups, that's how God has come into your life and how God has given you things to bring you closer to him, her. And so just those very groups of people that you've been privileged to meet, to work with, to serve, to learn from, and to teach, they've been vehicles of God for you in your life, as you
very
have been
powerful.
For them.
The more, and I don't know where, I know somebody wrote it somewhere along the way, but truly, the more I see, acknowledge, encourage the Spirit of God in another human, the more I experience God for myself.
Of course, yes.
And that's such an a peaceful mode to walk in.
Mm-hmm. But, and we need people who will do that on this earth during these times that are so turbulent.
And that peace that pervades, and that I just respect it so much. And you're, and we're going to get back to Nain. When did you co-found North American Interfaith Network?
Well, I wasn't actually co-founder. I was one of the original people that worked on it. I went to a meeting in 1986 in England where there was a British Isles Interfaith Network. And one of the things that they raised at this meeting, which was sponsored by the World Congress of Faiths in England, they simply raised the question, you know, there are interfaith organizations around the world. Should we be communicating with one another? And there was a resounding yes from everybody. And we came home from that meeting, and the Temple of Understanding hosted a preliminary meeting in New York to raise the issue of, you know, how could we form a North American Interfaith Network? And then from there, we put together a conference in 1988 in Kansas, in Wichita, Kansas, and invited Diana Eck, the Harvard professor who was in, you know, really spearheading some key thinking on interfaith work, and still is. And out of that came a really kind of a structured organization, out of that conference and the people that were there. And we had membership from Canada and from the United States. Mexico came in later. But at the same time, in the mid to late 80s, that some formal steps were being taken to crystallize all of this. Bettina Gray, who is now the chairperson of Nain, was discovering a lot of interfaith activity in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I believe she also discovered it in New Orleans. And so there were grassroots groups in various places, at least in the United States, that were beginning to reach out to one another. So, it, you know, the time was ripe for communication to really start happening. And the conference that we did in the first one in Kansas was very good. There were good people that were there to speak at it, and there were good participants, you know, to question and to go back and forth and so on. And then from that, we developed and refined as we went along the conferences, so that there was, now there's a conference every year, a Nain Connect every year. In the beginning, it was, I think, every other year or something like that. But at any rate, and we've gone back and forth. We've had some in Canada, and there have been some in the United States. And at this point, I think the committee work is well structured, and the opportunities to involve young people in this type of work is well structured. And, you know, NAIN is it's just a wonderful, wonderful organization, and it has grown. And as one of the founding people, you know, you look to the next generation and you see them moving in and taking over. And it's just exciting to think, you know, that there's an interfaith work that's passed on and that a new generation is now handling it.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're hosting NAIN in Dallas, not this year, but next year.
I'm told, yes.
Isn't that interesting that it keeps dovetailing around? Because here we go. I keep telling them that there's something going on here, because some people have said, well, Dallas, Fort Worth can't handle the parliament. I went, wait a minute. We're in my backyard, almost, well, my front yard, if I look 5 minutes away, there's the Cowboys, the new Texas stadium.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're having the Super Bowl there in January of next year. I believe if we can have a Super Bowl, we'll be able to deal with the parliament.
Probably.
Yeah, and our dear friend, your dearest friend, Ebby, is involved in the co-hosting of the Super Bowl. Because in this, of course. Ebby is remarkable.
Cute.
She will be 100 soon and just, quite. For those that don't know, Ebby is
Halliday.
Ebby Halliday, and those that aren't in Texas, there are people on the board, Elizabeth, from other countries listening to us now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How would you describe Ebby? She's truly a groundbreaker.
Ebby is one of the most remarkable women in the city of Dallas. She is a realtor. She's up from her own bootstraps and is a very wealthy and successful woman, and yet one of the most down-to-earth, kind, and generous people you would ever want to meet. She's received every reward, I think both local and national, that she could possibly receive, including the Horatio Alger Award, and is just beloved by the people of Dallas.
And
so
almost
I'm not
100.
Surprised to find out that she's co-hosting a Super Bowl. And Ebby is, I think she's 99 now.
Yes, her recent birthday.
Yes.
Well, speaking of marvelous people, would you talk about Brother David and explain who he is?
Brother David is a Benedictine monk from Mount Savior Monastery in Elmira, New York, who lives, I think he's still in Ithaca. He's born in Austria, came to this country, and entered the monastery shortly after it was founded. He has training in psychology and art history and restoration, and is an extraordinarily sensitive human being with a very artistic understanding and creative understanding of life. He's an author and lecturer who has written a number of books, Gratefulness, The Art of Prayer is one of them. He's done a thing on the listening heart, which was an earlier one, and he's done a whole lot more since then, which I have upstairs, and the titles don't come to mind right now. He has a marvelous website called gratefulness.org. www.gratefulness.org, if anybody wants to go to it. And you'll find just a lot of delightful opportunities to interact with the website in a grateful way and to learn from it.
Well, he has really supported spiritually and physically Thanksgiving Square all these many years.
Well, yes, and he's the one that introduced me to Thanksgiving Square, for which I am very, very grateful.
A lot of people didn't know that, and in fact, hindsight, I should have gotten in touch with him and had him.
I don't think you can get to him. I think.
Well,
that
I can get. I do. I can get to him through two of his assistants. I do, but.
Oh.
I don't know. He may be in. He spends a lot of time in a retreat type.
In seclusion. Yes.
Very contemplative person. And there's power in that. And that comes to this question. You chose to retire early in life because, you know, a lot of people involved nowadays, people don't even retire. You know, I don't know where that word retire. You know, you're so busy, yet you chose to move back into a contemplative lifestyle, move back into your tradition of Catholicism. And well, I want to ask you two questions. Number one, why did you do that, and what are you doing now? And does it? How can it impact the planet if you're in solitude a lot of the time? How's that possible? So
well,
first
of all,
why did you choose to go back?
Why did I choose to do that? Shortly before I made the decision, I spent a few days in England with Tamal Krishna Goswami, one of the Hare Krishna leaders, and we talked about my retiring, and I had been at Thanksgiving Square for 18 years as director, and before that I had been coming in on an almost annual basis to do programs for them. So I had been there a really good long time, and I remember Tamal Krishna looking at me and saying, sometimes, Elizabeth, you just know when you've been there and you've done everything that you could do. And he said, you're 64. You probably can't do any more there. Why don't you retire? And just his saying it that way kind of crystallized it for me. And my brother, Mike, and I had always talked about the fact that when one of us retired, we would both sell our homes, because he wasn't married, and I wasn't either. I'd sell mine in Dallas, he'd sell his in Oswego, New York, and we would find a house together, big enough to give each of us our space in the Syracuse area, which was where he worked. So that was what we did. It just seemed that the time was right, and we sold our houses easily without any difficulty, and we shared a home until his death a year ago, or almost a year ago. In coming here, one of the first things I did was to discover the Everson Museum of Art and become a docent there, which was a wise move and a gift of God. I just read a little article in the newspaper about they were looking for docents, and I thought, well, I've certainly lived a long time in the world of art since I taught it for so many years in the beginning of my career. I'll go do that. But what that did was introduce me to a whole realm of friends in this area who were not my brother's friends, so that I was developing my own circle. And then I was invited to get involved in a number of interfaith initiatives here in the Central New York area, which I did do for a time, but I kept feeling as if I was repeating myself, as if I'd been there and done that, and that wasn't the niche for me at this point in my life. And then, through some interesting circumstances, I discovered that there was a position open at a Catholic parish for a secretary. And when I applied for it, I got the job as secretary in this parish, which is not too terribly far away from my own home, and where the people are very profoundly spiritual. There's not a lot of attrition. They're older people for the most part, and there is a kind of a return to roots that I found going on. I should say that throughout my career, I never really worked in a parish per se after the first couple of years in the convent, where I was, I taught school. But then I got involved in broader levels than just one particular parish, like in the Diocese of Buffalo or whatever. And then finally Thanksgiving Square, which was local, national, and international work. So when I came back here, I wondered for a period of time, why am I in this little parish? Why is this where God has seen fit to send me? And it wasn't that I didn't like it, because I do like it. It was that I didn't understand until just recently I began to think, well, this is truly home. This is going back to roots. This is being at home. There are not a lot of people in the parish that I can talk to about interreligious matters or interfaith matters because it's not their experience or what they would understand. But I'm seeing again the beauty of some of the old customs of my childhood and making discoveries of these things that I grew up with in a whole new way after a whole lifetime of other sorts of experience and seeing the beauty that there is in, as Tracy was saying, the power of the local community, the beauty of the local community, the simple life, growth, death situations, the grieving, when you lose a loved one, the prayer of the community when someone is sick, just real simple everyday things and how profoundly moving those things are.
Well, I want to ask you right there, this brings up a very critical question. Within the community of the readers of the Urantia book, we're spread out around the planet.
Right.
And there have been times different groups have tried to create more than just, right now we function mostly with study groups and conferences, and there are retreats also. So there's three formats. But I'm going to use the word church because that does have a certain connotation to it. Different groups have actually bought historical buildings, so far that has never worked out. There, within our community, there's no ordination. Although Paula, who got us connected here, and I are ordained. I am ordained through Christianity, have been since the 80s, and I'm very fortunate in that area. They do know I read the Urantia book, and that's, I had to talk to the leaders of that, you know, to let them know. I can't keep that. And then she's ordained as an interfaith minister. Well, and now another couple of groups actually are seeking to create another center, a church, temple, whatever. Can you give some advice coming out of this book? You have read it. Is there any warning signs you could give us in opening up? What do you think about that? Because there are a lot of readers that do not believe that at this point this book should ignite another religion, I'll say, religion.
Well, that's an issue that you've been dealing with in Urantia book circles for many years. I know that there was talk about it when I went to Vancouver, and I don't remember exactly when that was, except the late 90s, I think. It seems to me that you would have to come together and come to be of one mind about it. If there's still great disparity, then will it be unifying, which is of the spirit, or divisive?
So just in the preparation of it, if the core group cannot come to a form of consensus, is that what you're saying?
I think that's what I'm saying. I think you find in the scriptures, as in the Acts, and as the Christian community grew, you know, the community members in early Christianity would speak with one another about what was right and you know, how things should be and so on and so forth. There was a thing in one of the scripture readings not too long ago about Peter and Paul, I think, talking about the fact that, well, you don't have to tell somebody coming into Christianity to be circumcised. You know, that was the Jewish way of doing things, but that didn't have to be, there was no reason to impose that on Gentiles coming in from in this new situation. So it seems to me that you'd have to have a guideline that is like, if it is of the Spirit, it unifies. Mm-hmm. If it divides us, then we need to look again at it.
Well, what's interesting, this is the dynamic of, I'm totally fine if a group wants, you know, to have a gathering or even a building. We do have a lot of people that read the Urantia book from different religious backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So could it be possible there will be different budding forth and blooming forth, like people of from a Jewish tradition, Christian? I'll use those two right now, you know, because I would say of the, and there are people that have backgrounds that still are very comfortable in their going to their own services, their own traditions, beyond, even other than Judaism and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm like trying to wrap my head around that. Establish that kind of a structure, and I've heard the word used now, creeds, and of course I think of the Apostles' Creed, and of course you know, being a Catholic, do you think that could cause potential problems for people that desire to read the book, and they, instead of seeing us as a group of religionists, that they see us as another religion? What do you think? It's a struggle.
It's got to be a struggle for you. I think probably you're not there yet. And where you have no clergy, unlike with the early Christians, you know, where Peter was the leader, so ordained by Jesus, and you did have leadership there. You have leadership within your Urantia Book Fellowship and so on, but as you said yourself earlier, there are no ordained ministers or whatever specifically for the Urantia Book, and I keep hearing people say the Urantia Book was given us as a book, not as a religion. You know, I can hear people saying that when I was at that meeting. So there probably has to be more study and more prayer and more consensus building and discussion. But something else that popped into my mind when you were saying, you know, can you be a reader of the Urantia Book and be a member of another faith tradition? You know, and I think of Buddhists who follow a way of life and do not necessarily call Buddhism a religion. And there are many people who follow Buddhist practices who are Christian or whatever, you know.
That's a very good point.
It seems to me that someone could be a reader of the Urantia Book and grow profoundly in spirituality for the fact of reading it. I mean, I think it certainly added to my growth just because of the beauty of some of the concepts and the language and the rapprochement to God.
Well, that,
you know,
was a great insight, because we, like I say, I'm not part necessarily, but I am observing and receiving emails, and it is a struggle. So you just, from your unique viewpoint, having been involved in Catholicism your entire life, I guess you'd call it ordained as a nun for many years.
No, it's not ordination.
I guess it's not called that. What do you call that?
You profess.
Profess.
You make your profession of faith.
That's an interesting term. Yeah, I used ordained because that's inside my framework. I always saw you as a powerful minister. And like I say to you, as I say to my friend Jim O'Brien, who left the monk order.
Right.
Once a monk, always a monk. Once a nun, always a nun. You carry that essence with you.
I guess.
Well, you do. Well, we have gone beyond the hour, which is great. And you've just totally
answered. Are people still listening?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I can see them on the chat room. And even we have people listening through Facebook that don't even show up in the chat room.
Oh.
And this goes into an archive. And we never know who's listening in the universe. You know, it's going.
Well, that's true. That's true. We never know who's listening in the universe. But it's been nice having a conversation with the universe. Thank you.
Well, and we've covered pretty much everything we talked about, and you really, one other question that I don't think we really approached, we're talking about Brother David, and I do have friends that live this lifestyle of almost seclusion, yet we're warned about being exposed to other minds. You seem to have struck a balance there. How does a person impact the planet if they're living such a contemplative life where they're not engaged with as many people, especially as they get older? How's that impacting the planet?
Well, if you think of the oneness of creation, the oneness of all people, the oneness of creation, if we pray, if I pray, if I ask God to bless the world, to heal the world. I do that because I believe that God is God and God can take care of that.
Mm.
And who knows the power of all that? Who knows the power of what God can do because we ask him or her?
And I love the way you keep him or her, because the Urantia book really clarifies that for me, that male feminine aspect of deity is
mm-hmm.
quite lovely to me.
Mm.
And Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. And
well, thank you for having me. It's been really nice, and thank you for bringing on Ed and Tracy. That was nice too.
Yes, and Paula, thank you. I know you're still there listening on the mute button, and thank you to the fellowship, because Paula is the executive director there, and she's working. She is working, and I'm not sure what happened. Even my calling card wouldn't work. So, but I've had trouble since I've been here getting through, so that's okay. It all worked out mighty fine. Now I'm going to have a hefty phone bill to recoup to our daughter. But that's okay, because for some reason my calling card wouldn't work, and my cell phone keeps cutting off, so I wouldn't dare call on the cell phone. But that money will be replaced, I'm confident. It was well worth it, Elizabeth. And Tracy is interested in being a part of bringing the Parliament of World Religions to Dallas in 2014.
That's a coup.
Man, what? People that are not from Texas don't just, what a remarkable human he is.
Yes, he's a good man. Okay, Annie, thank you very much.
Thank you. And see, people know that we're true sisters because you just call me Annie.
That's right.
I love you so much. And folks,
I love
remember,
you too. You
and
care.
Remember, folks, to come back Saturday at 11 o'clock Central Time for our sister broadcast. And so goodbye for now. God bless. And we'll end with my dear Pato singing Universal Love. Take it away, Pato.
In a world of so much hate, crime and injustice, what we need right now is some universal love. Unconditional love, y'all.